How did this, is it possible to get a copy of this from you?
Yeah, I think so. There's nothing in here that's classified. I mean, nothing written here.
Right, right, just, you just, yeah. These are just titles, but...
This, you see, is dated December 1961. We resumed atmospheric testing in 1962, and this document was used by Kennedy in his speech giving the arguments for that. That was facilitated because the Pentagon was infiltrated with guys from Livermore that we'd worked with for years, and Harold Brown was DDR&E at that time. He later became Secretary of the Air Force, and then under Carter, the Secretary of Defense.
I notice the name Ladder shows up.
Yeah.
A.L. Ladder.
Al Ladder was one of my colleagues at Rand, and later was head of the physics department there. His brother is Dick Ladder, who also appears in these things. Very, very good guys.
Well, I'm, in a general sense, I'm interested in how you had your position at UCLA, and we'll talk, you know, want to get to that, but you went through the ranks, became department chairman and everything else, and yet it seems like a lot of your activity was still in essentially a classified area of the Rand Corporation.
Yeah.
How did you balance those two things?
Just juggle them, I guess. I didn't do any any conscious attempt at balancing, but I guess I don't know how to say no to a bunch of things. You know, kept getting asked, for example, these are this is a group. And how group on weapons effects. I was asked by Benny Schriever, there was a, to go back to about 1960, there was a study made by Bill Shockley, the group, remember he was a solid state guy, on the potential vulnerability of solid state devices to ionizing radiation. That is, you got some kind of a switch that depends on conductivity or lack thereof, and if it's off, no conduction, and you got an ionizing radiation in there rendered conducting. Well, nobody paid any attention to that at that time, although they should have, and the subject came up again about 3 years later in a study, a big effort by Benny Schriever, who was then head of the Air Force Systems Command, very bright guy, called Project Forecast, which he was trying to look ahead 15 years or so at the problems of the Air Force. And this thing came up, and by that time there was now some experimental data about the effect of ionizing radiation on some of the logic solid state. It happened that this came just at a time after the Minuteman II guidance system had been completed and was almost ready to go into production. We had to stop that. Benny asked me to form a committee to look at that. It later got broadened, so we looked at the Navy stuff too. So I got to know all the Navy guys, Admiral Levering Smith and company, and they were in a better position because they hadn't committed the redesign yet. But those were days you could get things done. You know, I went into the Pentagon with this and briefed the General LeMay and the Secretary of the Air Force, Lookert. And there was a guy there, Sam Donnelly, that I'd known before, another connection, a major general. We went around the Pentagon, spent all day there, and we got $30 million signed off in one day.
Wow.
That's, you know, it was a big flap. So,
well, the Cold War was still certainly a big item at that time.
That's so. Right. Yeah. On that subject, these are reports of those meetings. All of them, TS. But there were some other thing, proposal for a declaration of geophysical world intervals in the fishbowl testing. We got that done. That was declared. A lot of those things were open. One of the reports, one of the RAND reports, was quite an interesting thing. It got me. This here, Aurora from the Teak Shot. The Teak Shot was a multi-megaton shot in the Pacific, very high in the atmosphere, that produced aurora at the north and south conjugate points, conjugate to where it was shut off. The reason for that was that you generate all these beta emitters in the nuclear explosion. They spiral around the field and go down and bang into the atmosphere and make an aurora. Well, we looked at that. And also the change, the aurora migrates with time because the fireball rises. So that got me interested in some of the geophysical effects, and I have a whole lot of things in the geophysical area to tell you about if we get time.
Okay.
But you'll see that many of these things are interconnected. That's related to the problem of the vulnerability of the missiles to radiation, mm-hmm. which is what that committee was about. Then back in 61, let's see, this is the Ad Hoc Committee on Radiation Effects. Back in 61, starting here, it became evident that from the intelligence that the Soviet Union was going to resume testing. And they finally fired off that 63 megaton thing. And so the idea was to get ready on our side to resume testing. You see, that moratorium had never had any official standing. It was just supposedly a gentleman's agreement, but they weren't gentlemen. So Harold asked me to form this ad hoc group on weapons effects, which later became called the Defense Atomic Support Agency Scientific Advisory Group on effects. SAGE, in other words. We were the SAGE advisors. And so we designed, that committee essentially designed all that series of tests, the Nevada atmospheric tests and the Pacific tests in that time frame. So all of these are reports that I wrote as chairman of that group.
Were you there for those tests then?
Oh yeah. Well, some of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I'm the only guy, probably the only guy alive now, that has seen two failures in one day. Two duds.
What was your reaction when you saw your first above ground test? How early was that?
Well, that was, I guess, 62 in the Pacific at Johnson Island. Pretty impressive.
I mean, obviously there were lots of pictures, but to see the real thing.
Yes. That's
Well, those are pretty exciting days. A lot of interaction with military. You know. Mm-hmm. Yes, I wanted to talk about that. Maybe we should do that now while we're on the subject, because that was one area you had delineated as a what you call tactical military technology.
Yeah.
And
tactical military technology.
You're listing, for example, back in 1966, the concept of the Phragmacord anti-personnel mine.
Yes. That, yes.
That's in some respects seems far afield from.
Well,
I mean, what was your involvement in that? Is it? Did you approach theoretical first? Is that?
You see, at that time. Well, it has to really, to understand it, you have to go back a bit. I noticed over the years in all these committees, they were always the same people. In other words, although you had thousands of academic personnel involved in World War II, scientific, you know, radar project and the VT fuse and chemical warfare and all that, all these birds dropped everything and went back to their ivory towers after the war. And it seemed to me that that was that's a real loss to the military. You'd like to see the military have the best scientific advice. And so I talked to Harold Brown about that and said, why don't we... I should tell you another problem. There's no way of getting new blood in that business because without some special devices, because the new blood doesn't have the necessary clearances and they don't know anything that's worth asking them their advice about. So the thought here was to educate a few of these youngsters so that they would become available. If you're asked to form a committee to do something or other, you know, it's always on a rush time scale, you're not going to get a bunch of amateurs. You're going to find people that know what the hell they're doing, have been that route, and can give you a quick turnaround answer. So the idea here was to develop a thing I called the Defense Science Seminar, which would take some of these young people, everybody under 35, and pump them up so they know what some of the issues and problems are. So I ran this for 3 summers during the month of August here at UCLA on a classified basis. The audience in each case consisted of about 45 people, roughly one-third coming from academia, another third from the military, right, officers, and a third from the government military laboratories. So we had a good mix in the group. And these guys lived and worked together, you know, really worked them pretty hard. If you're interested in that, I can give you a typical brochure.
Oh, sure.
All this stuff. In August 1966 gives the attendees and the speakers and
excellent.
We also had field trips to places like Picatinny and Naval Ordnance Lab, places like that, with demonstrations to lighten it up.
Excellent.
Many of the people that were involved in this went on to be at managerial level in military training. John Ballesfuller was one of them. He became deputy director of OSTP, for example. And he's over at Caltech now. Fred Hawthorne's another one.
Okay, yeah, those are familiar names. You were also involved with, and I noticed, just noticed briefly in that introduction there, with General Westmoreland in Vietnam as
yes.
well.
Yes, now that was really an outgrowth of this. I had known Johnny Foster from Livermore days. I didn't mention that when Livermore was getting started in 1952, they didn't have any theoretical group. So a number of us from the RAND Physics Department moved up there for the summer and constituted the theoretical group until they got going, and Johnny Foster was there at the time. Then later on, he followed Harold Brown to the Pentagon, and in talking with Westmoreland, this was in 1966, he decided that Westmoreland needed some scientific person at his elbow, and he persuaded me to take that job. As it happened, I was on a going around visiting the defense intelligence field sites with a group, and when we got to Saigon, I just stayed there, and Westy hired me on the spot, practically, and I lived with him in his villa. Had breakfast and dinner with him every day. So very, very interesting relationship. Wonderful, wonderful guy. So that's how that happened. Now you were asking about things like Pragmacord. There were all kinds of evident military problems in Vietnam. One of the problems was that you had these infiltrators. And much of these problems had not been addressed in any way by the scientific community. So I conceived this idea of having a linear mine, which you could lay along the trail, into the filtration trail. Often they have the drainage ditch along the sides of the trail that can get ground up. And the idea is you have scouts out so they know when this group, this infiltration group, is coming in. And you put an ambush for them on one side of the trail, and on the opposite side you put this linear Pragmacord in the ditch. And when they're all properly oriented, then you and you fire off the ambush, and they all dive for the ditch, and then you fire off the Pragmacord. So, you know, it's designed to stop that kind of thing. Now, the trouble was that we had, this comes in 25-foot lengths, we had about 1,000 of those built. And they came over there, and everybody was so enthusiastic about them, they fired them all in demonstrations. They had to reorder. Another time, another kind of project while we're on that subject. Before I went to Vietnam, I had read a book called Jambo, which means hello in Swahili or something, written by a guy who wanted to study the herds of African animals without disturbing them. And he wanted to get an overview from the air. Now, he tried this with an airplane, but that always frightened him whenever he got close. So he decided to become a balloonist. And he tells all the problems of getting a license and all that. And he points out that in a balloon, you don't have any relative wind motion, and therefore it's silent as a church. And you can hear children in a school play yard on the ground from a mile altitude.
I thought to myself, my God, what a wonderful kind of intelligence collection system that would be. We had found in Vietnam that under the jungle canopy, the Viet Cong had all kinds of things going on. They had a volleyball court, you know, making themselves at home. So I wrote to a guy in ARPA, then it was ARPA, not DARPA, and got back a horseshit letter, you know. But I kept trying, and when I got to Vietnam, it happened there was a very energetic guy by the name of Dick Cesaro in ARPA, willing to take some risks. Anyway, he had a group produce a blimp that was equipped with acoustic listeners. I had the idea that what you do with this thing is blimp, powered blimp, you fly it upwind on a dark night and then shut her down and float majestically over these areas, war zone C and D and so on, with your big acoustic ears listening. They locate the enemy. One of the problems, see, we never had a problem in Vietnam with defeating the enemy. The problem was bringing them into battle. Never could find the son of a bitch. So, anyway, this finally came out, this rig, which was done in a very, very hurried fashion. And I went out to an airfield at Long Bend to watch the demonstration. This was on a cloudy day. A typical day this time of year was cloudy in the morning and then the sun would come out. This kind of an amusing story. This blimp was painted black, and so it wouldn't show at night. But as a piece of the camouflage, it had letters on the side, Chu Hoi, which means, you know, come rally to the cause. Anyway, it had an electric motor and it had a stepping switch for turning the speed of the motor. And they got it blown up, and they were trying to run it up and down this runway, and it was clear it was just marginally under control. It had a pop valve, it was a helium balloon. But the guys that were running it hadn't thought it through. Now, imagine what happened now was the sun came out, the black thing got hot, and it expanded as much as it could expand into this flexible balloon. It wasn't a rubber balloon, it just expanded to fill the volume. And then it began to rise. Well, think now, the pressure inside maybe is 1.01 atmospheres or something. And the controllers decided they better bleed some of the helium off. Well, they did, but they didn't bleed off enough to reduce the atmospheric pressure, so the volume stayed the same, but the weight declined, and she shot up to 10,000 feet. Well, by this time, it was a traffic hazard to all of the aircraft. So they sent up a helicopter, a gunship, to shoot it down. Turns out you can't shoot down a balloon like that. You fill it full of riddled full of holes, but it takes time, you know. It finally settled, and it landed in a swampy area called the Rungsat, the poorest of thieves, the swampy region. Well, they didn't want all the classified collection acoustic gear to get lost, and so they went down with the bolt clippers, and they clipped off all that stuff, relieving it of about 300 pounds weight. And of course, then the obvious thing happened, the son of a bitch took off again. Last scene headed over Cambodia. Oh, there were some funny things happen.
Maybe we should just talk a little bit more about your military activities. And I'm just looking at the list that you had supplied me. 1970, developed concept for SAM defense suppression weapon, Delilah.
Yeah. The trouble, you see, we had things known as anti-radiation missile arms, standard arm, things like that, that home on the radiation signal. The trouble is that these are launched from aircraft, and that has a particular signature. The aircraft has to go into a rising motion, and the thing is then lofted. And on the radar, you see this thing separate, and you just shut down, and then it doesn't have anything to home on. So I wanted to solve that problem, because the SAMs were shooting down our aircraft in North Vietnam. And my approach was to use something like a missile that you could implant in the ground, as here this is like one of those ground implanted sensors that we used eventually. And what you do is you fly over this area where you know the SAMs are, within a kilometer or so, and you plant this thing, and it's sitting there, you know, with its listening device and its intelligence and whatnot, and it's listening for the radar to come up. When it comes up, there's a radar over here, and it sees that, it goes, and it gets there before the radar can shut down, and there's no aircraft in the air, no warning at all. So that's Delilah.
Okay.